March.
This meeting is
It's
being
not,
recorded.
no. I came up with something good. Don't worry. There is an old tradition that in the days, the weeks really, between Pesach and Shavuot, between Passover and Shavuos, there is a custom of learning what's known as Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers.
I was going to ask you to do that. You must be reading my mind.
Yeah, that's
No, I'm
what.
serious.
Okay, I'll
Sorry.
go with that.
Nice try, Robin.
No, I really was.
So
I was.
Pirkei Avot is it's interesting. The tradition has it to be studied the 6 weeks or so, because the first Shabbos is usually still Pesach. They don't do it, but the 6 remaining weeks or the 6 Shabbatot from Pesach to Shavuot, they learn one chapter each week. So I figure I'm going to give you at least give a sampling of some of the beautiful Mishnayot. That's what it is. It's a section of Mishnah taken from. There are 6 orders. Let me give you a quick primer. What is Mishnah? Let's start there. So you've heard me say many times that the concept of what we call the written Torah and the oral Torah, from a traditional perspective, the written Torah is the actual words that God dictates to be written down for us to have, and that's what we call the Torah. That's the scroll that we read, every Shabbat or on holidays. It contains the 5 books of Moses. That's known as the written Torah, the Torah Shebiktav. However, if you've ever had a chance to even read it, even just superficially, you know that it is not an easy read. It's not something that you can just, oh, pick it up, a little nighttime, bedtime reading. It doesn't flow like that. It's not meant to be. Clearly, there was an understanding, an explanation that went along with it, a companion work, which is what Moshe learned in the 40 days and 40 nights that he was up there. He learned all the details and all of the aspects of each one of the commandments and the stories. That's known as the oral Torah. And because those were the traditions that were passed down orally, they were not written down. For example, one of the classic examples, we know the Torah actually describes there's a mitzvah for tefillin. Tefillin in English, they call it phylacteries. It's the black boxes that are put on the arm and on the head. The fact that they are black, that they are square, that they are made of leather, that they contain 4 different paragraphs from different places in the Torah. It doesn't say that in the written Torah. And yet, every single pair of tefillin, and think of the number of millions, perhaps billions over the course of Jewish history, pairs of tefillin, they are all exactly the same. How can it be? Two Jews can't even agree on what shul to go to. Two Jews can't even agree on anything. How did we get this one right? Because there was a tradition that started from the very beginning of Moshe at Sinai, that God told him all the details. And those details were passed down orally from parent to child, from teacher to student. And it went this way for a very long period of time. Unfortunately, and I'm giving you the quick synopsis of history here, unfortunately, due to persecution and many other issues, it was becoming clear that the traditions were in jeopardy of being lost. A man by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, made an astounding decision that changed the course of history. And he, just as an aside, he was not a willy-nilly decision. He thought about it and fasted for many days. And he really sought God's counsel whether he should do this or not. And he made the dramatic decision to take the oral teachings that were the explanation for the written Torah and put it actually into writing, which he knew was not a simple decision because it was meant to be. God taught it orally and he wanted it to be oral. So he went ahead and he decided that he was going to write down in shorthand notes, very short paragraphs that would try to at least be what I would call shorthand notes of a lecture. I know Robin writes down every word I say, and she listens back to the recordings to make sure that she doesn't miss any right? She gets every one of them. But most of us, what we do is we record the basics. You write down a couple of words, shorthand notes, and that's enough to jog your memory of what was said. because you heard it. That's what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi attempted to do when he wrote down the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the first written record of all the oral traditions that had been previously for quite some time. He wrote it in a way that you still needed the oral traditions to explain. It was not pages and pages and pages of explanation on one verse or on one concept. They were written in short paragraphs. That was the attempt. And it worked for about 500 years. But again, because of persecution and many other issues of traveling and tradition perhaps being lost, what they decided, scholars of that generation, is that they were going to write the explanations that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was alluding to in the Mishnah, and to do it much more in a full elaboration. That's what we call Gemara or Talmud. The Talmud is the explanation and the elucidation of the Mishnah. If you were to open up today any text of the Talmud, you will see that it always starts quoting the Mishnah, and then the conversation begins in the Talmud of what is being referred to. And even if it's just remotely associated with the topic, that's all discussed in the Talmud. I would say that nowadays, if you say to somebody the oral Torah, they're referring to the combination known as the Talmud, the Mishnah with the Talmud. That's the general body of law. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote his Mishnah, he divided it into six orders, six major sections. One dealing with agriculture. Remember, Jews always were an agricultural society. So all the laws and related topics to agriculture, from the laws of Shemitah, the seventh year, the sabbatical, to the idea of not grafting trees and the idea of not planting seeds that are of different species close to each other, and laws regarding the first 3 years of a tree's growth, known as Arla, that you don't eat those fruits. All of those are different tractates. I'll call them, right? That's what they're called, tractates, within the order, the section of agriculture. All that is in book one. Book two are all festival related. The Shabbos, Pesach, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and others, all in book number two, known as Moed. Moed is a festival. Book three is known as Nashim. Nashim is women associated with marriage, divorce, the ketubah, Levirate marriage, things associated with men and, you know, husband and wife relations. That's a large part of it. There's another section. The fourth one is known as Nezikin, damages, tort law, right? For those of you attorneys, there's something called tort law. It's all the laws related to, you know, you get into, God forbid, someone gets into a car accident, who's liable and what a whole grouping on that. All the sections related to eminent domain, of dealing with who has the, what's it called? Possession is 9/10 of the law, that concept. There's a whole tractate related to this. It's all about damages and tort and law. The fifth and sixth sections are dealing with stuff that is not as prevalent or relevant today, dealing with what's known as kudshim. Kudshim is sanctity or holiness, dealing with the sacrifices and related topics. And then the sixth order, the sixth section, is called taharot, which is purity and impurity. Again, very little of it do we have in play today. This is known as the six orders of Mishnah. If you remember at the Seder, and you actually stayed up to the very, very, very end, and you did one of the songs, right? Is who knows one? I know one. One is Hashem. One is. But when you get to number six, it's six orders of the Mishnah. Oh, looky here. Now you know it. And then there's the five books of the Torah. Four mamas, three. Okay, so you know the song. Fine, so you know all this already. The six orders of Mishnah. Our section of Pirkei Avot comes from the fourth book of damages. Interestingly enough, it's in the book of Nezikin, damages. It's one of those tractates there. What makes this tractate of Pirkei Avot unique is that there are not one. There is an absolute zero number of actual law. There's no laws. Every other tractate deals with, it could be the laws about making vows. It could be the laws of regarding, you know, interpersonal business finances and business forum and law and all. Those are all laws, and they're discussed in all the other tractates. This one Mishnah, this one book of Mishnah, known as Pirkei Avot, has no laws in it. They are perspectives. They are the ethical view in life. I would like, over the next few weeks, to take a sampling of some of these Mishnayot, of some of these sections, to really have a conversation. So, here's what I want to do. Give me 3 seconds, and I'm going to pull up the Mishnah I would like to do. Hold on. Had it set aside, and someone moved it.
It is. I pushed the wrong button.
All right, here we go. Let me share my screen. All right, here we go. Here we go. It's the top line here. Can you all read it? Is it there? Joshua ben Parachia, Nitai the Arbelite. Can you see that?
Yes. Yep.
He received the oral tradition from them, from the ones that previously. This section of Mishnah talks about who gave over the tradition to whom. Joshua ben Parachia said, used to say 3 things. In Hebrew, Aseh lecha rav, appoint for yourself a teacher. Number 2, Ukenei lecha chaver, acquire for yourself a friend or companion. And 3, have a dun et kol ha'adam lekaf zechut, and judge all people with, you know, to the scale of weighted in his favor, otherwise known as judging people favorably. 3 teachings, none of them are novel teachings to any of you. But I hope that this evening, as we go through it, we're going to learn a couple of really new insights about this. So let's start with the very beginning. He says the following. Well, I guess I should start earlier. The Mishnah, I'll just scroll up and you'll see that it actually goes in pairs. Okay. Shimon the Righteous was one of the last of the men of the Great Assembly. Okay. He said what he says. Then comes the next. Antignus, a man of Socha, received the oral tradition from Shimon the Righteous. And here's what he says. Here we go. Next Mishnah. Yossi ben Yoezer, the man from Tzreda, and Yossi ben Yochanan, the man of Jerusalem, received the oral tradition from them, the previous 2, Shimon the Righteous and Antignus. Next, Yossi ben Yochanan, he says his laws. Now we come to ours. Joshua ben Parachia and Nitai the Arbelite received the oral tradition from them. And it goes pairs by pair by pair by pair, each one being quoted. The next 2. Judah ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach received the oral tradition from them. And here's what they teach. Shmaya and Naphtalion received the oral tradition from them. And it literally goes through who the Rebbe was, who the student was. And it goes one after the other after the other. Two famous ones, you know. Hillel and Shammai received the oral tradition from them. Hillel used to say, and here's a whole bunch of statements from Hillel. And here's Shammai. And then we ended off with the last ones, Rabbi Gamliel, his son, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, and then we move to chapter 2. Why is this significant? Why am I even pointing this out to you? You have to ask yourself a basic question. And I know Susan gave a little eyebrow raising when I told you that this was found in the section of Mishnah related to damages. What's it doing there? That's a weird place to be putting a whole book of ethics. And 2, let's start at the very beginning. Here's the very first, chapter 1, Mishnah 1. You ready for your first lesson in ethics? Moses received the Torah at Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders, the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly, and then they start their teaching. Really? This is how the book of ethics begins? What a weird beginning. My Torah doesn't even begin that way. It starts with, yeah, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, and here's what it was. It was astonishingly empty, and God said, let there be light, and yada, 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 yada. And God created man, and we move on. This I would have expected to be the first perek, the first chapter, first Mishnah of the very first book of the Mishnah. Not book number four. Again, the book of agriculture is the first book in the order of Mishnah. When you start a series, right? Sid, you're going to write a six-volume, an unbelievable compendium of the history of Frederick, Maryland. Six volumes. It's going to be a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for sure. Okay? And you want to give a little background to yourself, what your sources were. Do you put it in volume four? Or you put that in the beginning of volume one? Of course, volume one. And yet, this is applicable or is a good introduction to the entire concept of the Mishnah. As I explained to you, all of the oral traditions that are part of the Mishnah were all teachings that started with Moses receiving the Torah at Sinai. So this belongs, chapter one, Mishnah one, in book one. And yet, it's deferred until book four. Not even the first grouping in the book four. It's towards the end. Like, what is this doing in the only book that talks about ethics and values? The answer that is given is very profound. And that is, some people have the thought in their head that, yeah, okay, the Torah was given to us at Sinai, and Moshe learned it all, and he passed it on, and that's the do's and don'ts. That's the mitzvot. That's the things we have to do and the things we don't have to do, and all the details related to it. What we can and can't do on Shabbos, what we should and shouldn't be doing on Yom Tov, and what we need to do in terms of agriculture, and what we need to be careful of when it comes to damages, and who's responsible, the doctor paid. Okay, I can accept that. But values, ethics, I think it should be like this. And you think it should be like that. And the third person thinks it should be like something else. Or, if you want, let's take a more relevant example. And that is, that which was unethical just a few years ago, all of a sudden now in 2024, has become ethical and certainly not only permissible, but praiseworthy. And how we switch is an enigma to me. When it comes to ethics and values, the very first thing Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince wants us to know, this book of ethics is not my opinion. This is not Rabbi Judah the Prince. He's going to lay out for you his thought processes about what's right and wrong in perspectives about life. These are the same traditions, the same weight and value that we give to the laws that are passed down from Sinai all the way to it's codified in the Mishnah and then codified in the Code of Jewish Law. It is the same tradition, the tradition that starts back at Sinai from God to Moshe. These are not just ethical ideas that the rabbis thought of. The same oral tradition that told me that tefillin are black square leather boxes are the same oral traditions as to what is important in my life, what perspectives I need to have. So while, yeah, this could have been an introduction of book one, chapter one, Mishnah one, perhaps Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi saved it for where the biggest question mark might have come on the book of ethics and values. Don't be mistaken to think this is just what I think or what they thought. These are the exact same oral traditions received at Sinai from God to Moshe. And that's why it begins with this. But let's go to our Mishnah, okay? He says three things. Number one, Asei Lecha Rav. Make for yourself a teacher. Sounds like a good bit of advice, right? We would all agree to that. Make for yourself a teacher. Pick somebody. Does it say what kind of rabbi? Are there any qualifications to that? Doesn't sound like it. But listen to the wording. Is the wording one should have a rabbi? It doesn't say that. It doesn't say one should have a rabbi. It says make for yourself a rabbi. Do you hear the difference in terminology? What strikes you about the difference? One way of saying it is you should have a rabbi, and the other is make for yourself a rabbi. Let me throw it out there to you. What? How does that strike you?
That you're being invested in it, that you are invested in the teaching, not that the rabbi, not you're seeking it out. You were seeking the teaching out. You're making for yourself.
Okay. One aspect of it, Robin is suggesting, and that is you have to be proactive. You have to go out there and get yourself a teacher, right? Don't expect to just sit back there and have it land in your lap. More often than not, it's not going to happen. It may, but that's not what we should be doing. We need to be proactive and make for ourselves somebody. Excuse me. Somebody who can be my mentor, someone who could be my leader. Okay, what else? Somebody else had another perspective.
Well, I guess you have to find somebody that knows more than you and that you're comfortable with and you trust.
Okay, why is that so important?
Well, you don't want to find somebody that knows less than you.
That's true, but is it necessary? Listen, you got Michelle. What more do you need? She gives you all the guidance you think you need.
Yeah.
Sometimes a little more, right? Why is it so important? I'll tell you, you all know the answer why. Is because everybody, I believe, and you all, I think, agree with this, everybody needs a mentor. There is no such thing as I've arrived. Whatever level you're at, there's somebody who can give you guidance. I love the fact that in Talmudic literature, a Torah scholar is known as a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham. The words are so beautiful. The word Chacham means wise. Like we had in the Seder, the Chacham is the wise child. But what does the word Talmud mean? Talmud is a student. The greatest Torah scholar is known as a student of wisdom. Because he has to always still be learning more. There's always more to learn, and there's always someone from whom he can gain. You're never the guy. You're working on it, every one of us. Asay lecha rav, make for yourself somebody who can be your mentor. Nowadays, they call it a life coach. That's really what it is. I can tell you from firsthand experience that having somebody that I call my Rebbe, my rabbi, has been invaluable in my life. And you say, okay, when you were younger and you got guidance, I'm telling you, and I'm sure you've heard me quote this many times, I ask my rabbi certain questions, both in my own personal life and also when it comes to Judaism. Questions that I'm asked, I'm not sure I have the right answer. I go to somebody more experienced, who knows the answer perhaps. But certainly in decision-making in my own life, and my wife and I, we often will seek counsel from, we consider him our mentor. But Sid, you said something very good. And that is, it's not just a scholar. It has to be someone you're comfortable with who knows you. I'm a very strong believer in that. It has to be someone who you're comfortable to share a personal thing and you want their advice. You don't want just, you know, the magic eight ball rabbi who can just shake it and say, that's a really good question. The answer is maybe, you know? That's, it has to be someone. I can tell you again, many examples of where I asked a question and it for me was one answer and for my brother was a different answer. wasn't a major issue. And, like for me, he said pork was okay. And for my brother, he said it was. It wasn't something like that. No. It was a good example. Unfortunately, when my brother and I were, I'd lost our father, and we were, already, I guess a month, 5 weeks or so, maybe 6 weeks after he had passed away, we hadn't shaved in our hair. We needed a haircut. So the rule is that when it comes to parents that pass away, so the child, it's not an automatic 30 days and then, okay, it's over. When it comes to parents, there's the law is that it has to be, someone has to comment that you really look disheveled. It can't just be, oh, good, 30 days, it's beginning to look at, I can shave. No, it had to be. So I remember going over to him. My brother and I were both already, 6 weeks without a haircut, and it was looking pretty bad. And the answer he gave me was, not yet. My brother came in, I think that day or the following day, and the answer was, yeah, it's fine. And we were wondering a little bit. And the answer was, is because he knew my brother, who's out in the business world, it made a bigger impression if it was not as kept up as it should have been. He wasn't going to be lenient to say he can do it early, but he felt, all right, it reached the point of where, all right, at this point, it's probably considered on the, you can get into it's disheveled. I'm not in that world. And if the rabbi has a longer beard for another week or so, so be it. No one's going to question that. Okay, the rabbi's growing his beard. And he felt that. So you have to know the person, and you have to know the circumstance, and you have to know the context. You can't just, it's not cookie cutter answers. The only way that happens is if you have a personal relationship. And therefore, the Mishnah starts with, you have to make for yourself. I'm stressing the word yourself. Robin stressed the word you make for yourself. I'm adding to that. And I'm saying you have to make for yourself someone you're comfortable with, someone you know, someone who knows you. Make that person your rabbi who can give you some guidance. That's stage number one. Okay? But let's keep reading because look what else is added here. Number two, right? You said appoint for yourself a teacher. Acquire for yourself a companion or a friend. Anybody note the wording differently?
Acquire versus make.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. Acquire. What does it mean to acquire?
Obtain.
How?
Reach out.
How's that
Find.
different than make for yourself a
Well,
rabbi?
make you find someone. You tell them this is what you want them to be, and acquire would be something that's already there that you need to locate, find, obtain, bring to you.
But doesn't acquire have an even deeper connection than just obtaining?
Like buy.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
exactly the word. It may actually cost you something. You see, to my own detriment, the Mishnah says that you make for yourself a rabbi. Does it say the rabbi has to agree? No, tough noogies on the rabbi. If I consider you my Rebbe, I consider you my teacher, and I'm going to come to you, well, suck it up, Tuchman. You got to deal with it because people are turning to you for guidance. Then that's the way it is. You see, but when it comes to friendship, it's a two-way street. If I don't want to be your friend, you can say whatever you want. I don't have to go along with it. Friendship is much more of a two-way street than it is when it comes to rabbi student. The student is in the driver's seat when it comes to choosing a rebbe, choosing a rabbi. The student is in the driver's seat. When it comes to friendship, they're on equal footing. And therefore, when it says you have to be willing to acquire a friend, that means I have to give of myself and he or she has to give of herself. There has to be a give and take. Even if it means that the person's going to call me of all people at 2 in the morning because their car doesn't start. Or they got stranded on the beltway. Yeah, that's what it means to acquire a friend. Just as an aside, it doesn't say anywhere that you should call the rabbi at 2 a.m. because you have a flat. I just want to make sure we're clear on that. That's what friends are for. Yes, Robin.
Yeah, I have a question about the word companion. I was taking that to mean more. It could be a friend, but I was always taking that to mean more a partner in life, like a husband or wife.
It could be. I'm not sure that the English, the Hebrew word is chaver. Chaver is a friend.
Okay.
So that's English. Usually the translation of chaverim.
Although your partner should be your friend too. So.
Correct. There's no disagreement there. But the point that I think the Mishnah is making, in contrast to the rabbi, where you have to extend the effort and you have to make it happen and you make that call. When it comes to friendship, it's give and take. There needs to be an acquisition, an actual acquiring. And if it means, Sid, that you have to pay me to be your friend, okay, I'm willing to accept that. I'll be your friend for the right price. You know, the truth of the matter is, when it comes to friendship, it really is such a critical part of who we are as a people and as individuals. We need friends. We, the human species, needs that friendship. We all need it. We all need it. There's such a beautiful idea. Some of you may have heard that there's a book, as one of the 24 books of Tanakh, known as Eov, Job, it's called in English. Some people pronounce it Job, and that's probably why they're still unemployed. But it's Job, and it's a fascinating story. It's not one that I have a great grasp on, a lot of theological questions about it. But the basic storyline of the story of Eov is that he's a very righteous individual, and he has a lot of good things in his life. He has a family, he has wealth, he has cattle, he does very, very well. And the story goes, whether it's a true story or not is unclear. It may just be a parable, but it might actually be a story, whatever. The point being is that the Satan, goes to God and says, sure, he has faith in you. He's got everything good. Why don't we test his faith? Let's see. Let's tighten the screws on him a little and see if he's still such a believer. So God basically acquiesces. He says, okay, Satan, you have free rein to do anything you want him, except one thing, one condition. You cannot kill him. You can't kill him. And the story goes that he makes a bad business deal and he starts losing his wealth and his cattle die. And then he loses some children and then his wife dies. I mean, he goes through some really, really difficult tsaras, real difficult time. And each time he's still hanging strong and he's still calling out to God. And okay. But here's what's fascinating, and it gets lost in the storyline to some people. Throughout every challenge, he discusses the challenge with some of his friends. That's the key in the whole story. He discusses it and he says, I know why God is doing this, but I believe it's for my good. And all the things that, what it means to be tested, his faith was tested. But he discusses it with his friends. And one of the great commentators asked a simple question. Why didn't Satan get rid of his friends? Tighten the screws even more. If that's his go-to for him to remain strong, that he has a support group to discuss it and to give him the inspiration to keep going, then get rid of his friends. And the commentator answers that a person who goes through life without friends, it's as if he's dead. That was the one condition God said. You can't kill him. Taking away his friends is killing him. That you have no permission to do. It's such a keen insight of what it means to have friends in our life. To the extent that the Mishnah says, you even have to acquire it. You have to put in the effort. And if it costs you, I'm not talking money, but if it costs you with time, energy, effort, mishigas that you have to put up with because, you know, that's what friends do, then that's what you have to do because you have a friend. In the terminology of the Talmud, it says, O chavruta, o mituta. Either give me a friend or give me death because I can't be without it. Perfect, perfect, perfect explanation. Friendship is so critical. The word for friend is chaver, but the root of the word chet bet resh, those letters, means a point of connection. That's really the literal translation. A chaver is not really literally a friend. Chibur. I'll give you an example. What's the name of the city in English? They call it Hebron. What's it called in Hebrew?
Hebron.
The root of the word Hebron is chaver. Doesn't mean it's the city of friends. It's the city of connection. It's the point of connection. It's not for tonight. And we talked about it when we did a whole series on the cities in Israel. But the Zohar writes that the entrance to the Gan Eden, the entrance to the Garden of Eden, is behind the cave of Machpelah. Whatever that means, I don't know. Don't go snooping around. It's not good. It's not good for you. But that's what the Zohar writes. The Zohar writes that the connection, so to say, between this world and the next, between the physical and spiritual world, is in the point of connection. A chibur is in the city of Hebron. That's why it's named what it is. Oh, he's got Aiden. It's got to get there. Yeah. Okay. So that's what. So kene lecha chaver. So you have first level is, as Sid put it, somebody who knows more than you. Perhaps we can say is on a higher level, a mentor of sorts that can give you guidance. Watch what happens next. Then you have someone on your level, a friend, a compatriot, someone, you know, yes, friends can be older, friends can be younger, but it's somebody you connect to on your level, not in a mentor role, right? Agreed? Watch, look at the third one. Now we go to the third teaching. And what does he say? He says, and judge all men favorably. Everybody, judge all men. Dan et kol ha'adam l'kaf zechut. Judge every single person to the scale weighted in his favor. Judge people favorably. Who is that talking about?
Neighbors, strangers.
Anybody and everybody. People that are not, so to say, higher than you, a mentor, not even somebody who you consider to be on your level, but even some five-year-old little pisher. You see, do something wrong. Whoa, don't jump to conclusions. Find out. Judge the kid favorably before you come down harshly on the kid. Everybody, not only someone, you know, above you, not only someone who's on your level, but everybody, even quote unquote, that is not on your level. Everybody should be given that opportunity to be judged favorably. I had a story. I know I've shared it, but it's a good story. It's worth repeating. I was living in Columbus and it was the afternoon and I needed a quick pick me up. So I went across the street to the CVS and I wanted to buy myself a Hershey bar, you know, just a quick chocolate fix, give a boost of energy to get me through the afternoon. So I go in and sure enough, fine, no problem. I go in there and I buy a Hershey bar. I pay for it. And as I'm walking out the door, I notice that it's a Hershey bar with almonds, which I can have it, no problem. I just wasn't in the mood for it. So I made a quick U-turn and I went back into the store and I walked and I motioned to the cashier. I said, I'm sorry, I just picked the wrong Hershey. It's the same price. Can I put this one back and take just the regular milk chocolate one? She says, no problem. Sure enough, I put it back. I take the milk chocolate one and I walk out the door. Not 2 seconds later, a guy comes out behind me and he says, Rabbi, I'm so disappointed. I can't believe I just saw what I did. And I'm thinking, okay. Is there something I don't know about? I mean, is there a ban on Hershey bar? Is this some latest craze of a boycott? What's the issue with the Hershey? Okay, maybe he's angry. I should be on a diet. I don't know. Couldn't understand. I said, what are you talking about? What? How did I disappoint? He says, I would have never expected. I came into the saw and I saw you walked up to the thing. You took a Hershey bar and you left without paying. I can't believe it. I said, Jack, I am so glad that you came over to me and shared this with me. Let me fill you in on the rest of the story, right? What was that guy's name? Paul Harvey, right?
Yeah.
Now you know the rest of the story. What? And I shared exactly what had happened. It literally was that exact moment after I put the Hershey with almonds back. He walked in, saw me grab the Hershey without it, and walk out. It happens all the time. We judge people so quickly, these snap decisions, and we don't know the whole story. It's a true story. I'm telling you, it happened to me. It taught me a tremendous lesson about eating Hershey bar. No, it taught me a great lesson about being cognizant that you don't always know this whole story. We do. What's in it? Because that's who we are. We're judgmental people. We have to work on ourselves not to be. It's so easy to see the flaws in others. It's so easy. Yeah, you're right. It's within us. But it's also within us to override that system and to give people the benefit of the doubt. And I want to show you, this is where having, you guys are all already in my advanced group here, and we can really read the words very precisely in Hebrew. I want you to see it in Hebrew. Okay? Here's the key phrase for me. How do I close that? There we go. Lost it there. The key phrase for me are these three words. Et kol ha'adam. Here's the Hebrew, the whole phrase is the heve, and one should be done, judge, et kol ha'adam, simply translated as every person, lekaf zechut, to the scale, to the side that's weighted towards the merit, towards favorable. But the phrase here, et kol ha'adam, literally does not mean every person. That's not how you speak Hebrew. You would not say et kol ha'adam. You might say et kol adam. That might be. But et kol ha'adam, the whole person, is a more precise translation. One should judge the whole person favorably. What does that mean, judge the whole person favorably? Exactly my story. When you see somebody do something, you do not know the whole person. And I don't care how well you know them. You don't. I don't care if it's your spouse who you've been married to for 60, 70, 80 years. You still don't know the whole person. Why? Because you don't know. Did they have a rough day at the office? Did something happen? Did someone say something that upset him or her? You don't know. And all of a sudden, you walk in the middle of a story. You don't know. We have no right to judge anybody until we know the whole person. And since you can never truthfully know the whole person, give them the benefit of the doubt. I love these words. They jump off the page once you see the insight. Judge, yes, it means judge every person, but the precision in language is judge the whole person. That makes all the difference here, right? We're very, very quick, and we rarely know the whole story, but we take snapshots. Oh, this is what I saw. This is for sure. What happens if I know this is for sure what happened, though? I'll tell you, here's a good example. Here's a good example. The Talmud tells us the following. The Talmud says that if a person judges his fellow favorably, God will judge that person favorably. Sounds like a great deal, doesn't it? If you judge people favorably, then God will judge you favorably. Who wouldn't want that? Right, Muriel? Wouldn't that be like that's like an ace in the hole? But theologically, that one?
Isn't it like do unto others?
It sounds like it. And this is extending it even further. This is saying if you do it, God will do it to you. I mean, you can't beat that one. Except there's a real problem with that expression. Because what's the reason I just told you why you have to judge people favorably? What's the real reason at the root, at the real core? Why do you give people the benefit of the doubt? Because you don't know the whole story. There is really, it may only be a 2%, a 1% chance, but you don't know the whole story. You can't, because you're human. So then how can I go ahead and apply if you judge people favorably, if you give people the benefit of the doubt, then God will give you the benefit of the doubt. We're talking about God. There's no doubt. God knows the whole story. He knows what crappy day you had. He knows the whole story. Where's there a giving you a benefit of a doubt? There's no doubt when it comes to God. Sandy, you hear my question? It's a hard question. This piece of Talmud is very, very tricky. If you judge people and give them the benefit of the doubt, then God will give you the benefit of the doubt. But there's no doubt in God's mind. Yeah, Susan, take it away.
I think it is because I think it's that this just shows that it is so important to God that we behave. Of course, God knows, and God knows, but we do not. But this is that it's not a, it's not a, it's certainly not recipro- you know, it's certainly
So you want to say
not.
it's just meant as to impress upon us, but it's not to be taken literally.
I think it is to be
But
taken.
where's the
It,
doubt? How can it be? God will give me the benefit of the doubt.
I don't think it's about that. I
That's
don't
the
think it's.
words. You're right. If the Talmud wanted to impress upon us, it could have said, someone who gives people the benefit of the doubt, God will be merciful and, lighten their judgment. Okay, I can live with that. But that's not what it says. It says, one who judges his fellow favorably will be judged favorably by God. How can that be? Think about it. Go ahead, Robin.
Is it that we are made in God's image, and because God judges people favorably, we are supposed to emulate God and then do what he does, and then God will also judge you favorably because
Yeah,
you're
but
human?
I'm with you on the concept, but that last part, God will judge you favorably. Why do I judge people favorably? Because there's a doubt in my mind. There's no
Also
doubt in God's mind.
because we're emulating God, and
I
since we're
get
supposed
it.
to.
I know our perspective, why I should do that, because we're emulating God. But to use the expression, if you judge people favorably, give them the benefit of the doubt, God will give you the benefit of the doubt. Those words are problematic for me. So I'll tell you what the great Chafetz Chaim answered. Gave such a beautiful insight. When I was in college, so they had there was a tradition which professors to take and which ones to stay away from. There are certain professors, they're great. They're great people and they're extremely knowledgeable, but they're not great communicators and difficult to understand. And then there are others that we have a tradition. They're very easy graders. You wrote true, you meant false, it's close enough. Those kind of graders, those are the people you want. So there's a tradition about easy grading, The Chafetz Chaim said, that's really what's going on here. Of course, there's no doubt in God's mind. Of course not. But, and listen to how he phrases it, if you're the kind of person that gives others always the easy grading, you're always an easy grader on them. They do something and you're like, well, I know it looks that maybe they were having a rough day. Yeah, I know they screamed at you, but let it go. Let it go. You're an easy grader when it comes to the treatment of others, says the Talmud. God will do the same for you. He'll be an easy grader. Yeah, I know you did that Aveira, you did that sin, but you weren't thinking. You weren't thinking, or you're under so much stress going on right now, and you grabbed a quick bite of something, and you probably shouldn't have done it, and you probably regret it. If you're an easy grader and you always are giving people that benefit of the doubt, God will be the easy grader. That's how he writes it. That's the terminology he says, right? If you're not exacting and demanding on every little thing and not forgiving, God says, I'll do the same thing, right? You give it, you got it mostly right. Wouldn't that be great? After 120 years, we go up there and God said, you know, not one single mitzvah did you do 100% correctly. Even when you did the mitzvah, you were thinking about something else. Or you shook the lulav and you did it wrong. Or you ate the matzah and you put it up your nose instead of eating it. Yeah. Come on, not one. So God says, well, let me see. What kind of person are you? People would treat you a certain way and you would be like, yeah, okay, it's not exactly like that. Okay. He meant it for the best. His intentions were good. Cut him a little slack, right? You ever hear that expression? Cut him a little slack. God said, if you're the kind of person that's always cutting people slack, guess what? I'll cut you a little slack too. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, it's scary to think if it were the other way. If we're so demanding and so exacting of others, and everything has to be exactly like, you know, like, why can't you just follow my directions, Tachman? Just follow my. Why do you have to ask 100 questions? Just do it. Then God's going to do the same thing. Why can't you just do the mitzvah like I told you? What are you asking so many questions? Right? The boomerang hurts. So therefore, the advice that the Talmud gives, if you generally are easygoing and you give people the benefit of the doubt and you're not so demanding on every little thing, it's exactly, you're close enough. No. Then that's what God will do for us as well. So now, let's put the whole Mishnah together and we'll end it. The Mishnah is giving us one perspective, and that is that when you have any relationships in life, whether they be in the form of a mentor and a student, a teacher and a student, or a relationship with a compatriot, a friend on your level, or even those that are, I'll say below you, but I don't mean it in a negative term. I mean, they're younger than you. They don't have the experience or the knowledge. They're just, if we focus on what we can glean from each one of those relationships, and you need all three. You need all three. You have to have a mentor that can guide you. You have to have a friend to talk things over with, and you have to be nice and courteous to everyone. Give them the benefit of the doubt, then you have absolutely nailed all relationships in your life. That is the perspective of this Mishnah. This is what the Mishnah is teaching us. In the court of public opinion, give people the benefit of the doubt. Work hard at your friendships. Don't take them for granted. It needs an acquiring. And yes, no matter what stage in life you are, there's more to learn and you have what to glean, and find someone who you can glean it from. Choose them. Choose the person. Don't give them an option. Make for yourself a teacher. Those are the three things that the Mishnah is teaching us here. And I think, whatever, there's more to say, but I think we'll leave it at that. Let me hear if there's any questions, any thoughts, any comments. No? Okay. If you want to find this Mishnah, again, it's chapter one, Mishnah number 6. 1-6 is this one. All right. Great. Excellent. And we ended right on time. Wow. We don't have to be so exact. You know, cut me a little slack. Stay an extra minute. Won't kill you. Seriously, any? Oh, Robin, there. Shoo. I knew we couldn't finish in
I know
time.
you wanted to end it. This is more of a, I guess, a comment, but it possibly turning into a question. When you talk about the whole person judging the whole person favorably, I took that to also mean the physical and the spiritual aspect of the person, meaning that you don't know what the person is spiritually. You might see them doing something, but you can't judge them spiritually, not just the physical part. Would that be correct?
100%, 100%. We, as a general rule, externals, I mean, whatever, we know this from life. I'm not telling you what you don't know. You know, you can't judge a book by its cover. You can't. A person may dress a certain way and be amazing individuals. That's one of the reasons why, by the way, that we don't focus so much on clothing, right? It's a softer, you know, not the most flashy. because that's not what I want people to focus on. When they meet me, I want them to get to know me. You know, I'm pretty bland. I'm black and white. That's all I wear all day, every day. You know, my pajamas, black and white.
Stop it.
My shower curtain, black and no, seriously, it's just simple. You know, because I don't want this to be focused on, oh, look what tie he's wearing today. It's not about my tie. It's about me. I want to get to know me. I want you to know me. I want to get to know you. And not to be, so you're right. You may see somebody on the externals look a certain way, right? But spiritually, they're soaring. And you shouldn't judge them that way. It's a good rule in life. Get to know the person, the whole person, to the best of your ability. And you'll see that there's so much more to them. Human beings are the most complex organism out there. We all know that. Not just in the physical, just we are the most complex. We're still figuring stuff out in science. Yeah, so what? Because you meet somebody for 2 minutes, you think you can figure them out? Ah, oh, yeah, that's, oh man, not another one of those guys. Oh, good Lord, right? Why? Because you saw the guy for 1 minute, 5 minutes? Candy.
Yeah, when you said about black and white, I had a flashback to 1 year it was Hanukkah, and I said to Rabbi Cosman, he had a dreidel tie on, and I said, oh, Rabbi, I love your dreidel tie. And he said, ah, clothes. He said, I don't care about clothes. I wish I could just paint them on and leave them. So I just, when I think about him and tie, that's...
He totally subscribed to this concept. Oh, totally. I'll tell you one last story and then I'll let you go. Really. Yeah. As I joke, you know, I wear black and white all the time, pretty much. Every now and then I'll throw in a gray and a blue, but it's pretty simple. I went to a wedding and of course I wore a nice black suit with a nice white tie, a white shirt. And right after the wedding, I was going somewhere else and my wife was heading back to Baltimore. And I asked her if she wouldn't mind just taking my suit home. I would change into just, you know, quote unquote, regular clothes. And I was getting a ride with a friend, my cousins. So fine. So my cousins are ready to go. And I said, just give me 2 minutes. I'm just going to run and change. I go to the bathroom. I change, give my wife my suit, tie, fine, go. And I get in the car. We're driving a couple of minutes. And my cousin says to me, I thought you ran into change. I said, I did. He said, I understand. You changed from black and white to black and white? I said, yeah, certain blacks and whites are more comfortable than other blacks and whites, but thanks. That's what I wear. I wake up in the morning. I don't have to stand at the closet with my hand on my hip and, you know, just keep going through my shirts and my pants. And, yeah, that's the one. That's the one. It's just, okay, we'll try that one. And I went, okay, see ya. I'm out the door in 3 minutes. See you later. Very simple. Anyway. All right. Have a wonderful week, everybody. We will see you again, God willing, next Wednesday. And we'll pick another Mishnah from another chapter. That's okay with you guys. Perfect.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. So